It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster!
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat!
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. Congratulations! Who hasn't beat Daniel Garcia?
This is episode 938 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 16th, 2025. I am the Solo Monster. Legendary NWA announcer Bob Caudle passed away this morning. News of his passing was revealed by his son Mike, who noted that he died in his sleep overnight. He was 95 years old. God bless him. We should all be so lucky to live that long. Caudle just lost his wife in April, not long after the couple celebrated their 76th wedding anniversary. And they leave behind 3 children, 7 grandchildren, and 12 great-grandchildren. That is quite the family there. You know, as someone who grew up watching WWF television in the Northeast, as a young fan, I really had no exposure at all to Bob Caudle, and only became familiar with him, you know, later on as I went back and watched old NWA and WCW stuff. And he was a very straight-laced, kind of like broadcast journalist type. You know, he wasn't over the top. He wasn't like a heel commentator or anything like that. Didn't make himself, you know, the center of attention. He was that guy with credibility that you would tune in every single week. Oh, it's Bob Caudle. Probably the way that people who are watching WWF would look at, you know, like a Gorilla Monsoon or someone like that. And he wasn't even like Gorilla, and that Gorilla could be over the top sometimes. So, yeah, there were a lot of fans who grew up for years and years, and they would tune in and watch their wrestling in the morning, you know, Mid-Atlantic or whatever it might have been. And Bob Caudle was the voice, you know, of their childhood. And it's very sad to hear that he's passed away. His go-to line on all those old Mid-Atlantic Championship wrestling shows at the very end, his sign-off was, "So long for now." So I will say that about Bob Caudle, "So long for now." I've got news to get into on the location for Elimination Chamber, why it's a big deal. SmackDown moving back to 3 hours. That sound you hear is my soul dying on the inside. Got news on John Cena's final Raw match tomorrow and last match ever next month with this tournament. The lineups for War Games have mostly been completed. Not totally yet, but we're just about there. LOL TNA lives. Blood and guts thoughts. Full gear predictions, including thoughts on MVP's latest comments about one Paul Levesque. Well, he really does not like that man. And PWI just dropped its list of the top 250 women's wrestlers in the world. And I've got thoughts to share on the top 10. That'll be part of the mailbag a little bit later on. If you would like to support the podcast now running 18 years strong, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a special shout out here on this show. I want to say thank you to Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Diamond Dallas Dance Machine himself, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Cape Cod Crusader, Chris Setterland, Josh Bad Medicine Medina, Tough Guy Temjin Zephyr, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard. Maybe I'll see you and Mama Eichard on Friday, I hope. The Wichita Workhorse Clayton Nettleton, Yeehaw indeed. Russell the Muscle, thank you. He's been here with me since day one. Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar. Killshot Keith Hart. Jason the Boner Ventura. That is his name. And also, I want to give a shout out to the Boner's girlfriend, Queen Mallory Twenter. They have been dating for 4 years now, and she has supported him through a lot over those 4 years. So congrats to the two of them. Jason does a monthly reading at the local daycare near his library. Typically he says he reads Marvel or Disney stuff. But he tested out my mom's children's book, The Adventure of Hardy the Horse, which you can buy right now on Amazon. Cheap plug. He's done 6 readings so far, and the book has been a big hit apparently. So I love hearing that. And it's like I told him, I started doing readings myself to kids right before COVID shut everything down. And I really wish I could have done more. So this is very cool to see. This Tuesday, Bret Hart's book, which has been out for a number of years and is probably the best, certainly one of the best wrestling books ever written, one of the biggest ones, is coming to Audible officially. It's been available for pre-order. It still is available for pre-order right now as we speak. But the audiobook drops on Tuesday with 25 hours worth of narration from the Hitman himself. You can wait if you want to until Tuesday and use our Audible link here to buy the book, or you can pre-order the book right now for free when you use the link audibletrial.com/solomonster. So whether it's today, tomorrow, Tuesday, make sure you jump on that deal. It may not always be there. And get yourself a free audio version of arguably the best wrestling book ever written. And don't sleep on that Natty book either. Natalia's memoir is out. The audio version is also on Audible. So if you're an Amazon Prime customer, use my link and you can get two free books instead of just one. And if you can get two instead of one, I don't know why you wouldn't take advantage of that. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. Last night, House of Glory presented its Super Clash show from Brentwood, New York, in conjunction, in collaboration with the Big Event Expo for the first time ever. The Big Event is the biggest autograph expo to hit New York each year, usually twice a year. And this is our first time partnering with them. It was a huge success. We had a sold-out event last night, well over 1,000 fans. I met many of you there who either were at the event or at least the convention. So that was very cool. It was great to catch up in person with Chris Van Vliet as well. So that was nice. Now, I arrived pretty early in the day, but the convention itself started at 10. So the convention went from 10 to 4, then they cleared everybody out, and then our event started officially at 8. And I got there probably midway, a little past the midway point of the convention. So I did not bear witness to any of this, but I know that Bill Goldberg was there. Bret Hart was supposed to be there, but he had to pull out of some East Coast conventions a few weeks ago. This was one of them. That would have been very interesting. But, you know, Sting was there. Great Muta was there. This is probably one of the last conventions Sting will be doing in the face paint because he said he's going to stop doing that at the end of the year. But Bill Goldberg was there. And K&S WrestleFest shared on social media. Now, they have since taken this Facebook post down, but they did post on social media that Goldberg did not participate in a previously scheduled private autograph signing that they had agreed to and that they had set up for him. This is what they said. Unfortunately, Goldberg's private signing did not happen. We had all of our items laid out, ready to sign, as Goldberg was doing another private for another vendor. After he was done, he got up and said he was done. He walked out right past our stuff and he left. We are all super disappointed and frustrated. My apologies to all. And he was apparently, you know, he was at the big event as far as, you know, there's pictures of him chatting with Sting and signing autographs and taking pictures. But evidently this other private signing, he just walked right past these guys and right out the door. So there you go. That was the Goldberg controversy coming out of the big event. But as for the event itself, a lot of great matches in the card. Of course, the one that got the most attention. It actually had HOG trending on social media number 2 behind UFC. It was Mercedes Moné challenging for title number 13 in the main event against Noor Phoenix Diana. Out of Malaysia, she has been the APAC Wrestling Women's Champion for well, or had been now, for over 700 days. She had made it very clear it was a dream of hers to get a match with Mercedes. Mercedes is the one many years ago, 10 years ago, who inspired her to take a shot at wrestling in the first place. So this was a big match for her, and she traveled all the way to the States. This was only the second time that she has defended that title on U.S. soil. And Mercedes Moné goes from Mercedes 12 belts to now Mercedes 13 belts as she is victorious. Is 13 her unlucky number? Or does she make it number 14 next weekend against Chris Statlander? We shall see. But it was very cool to be on the call for that one. You could probably hear it in my voice right now. But we're not done yet, because House of Glory is coming right back this Friday with our return to the Windy City, November 21st. We are already sold out in Chicago. So this is going to be back-to-back sold-out shows for us in less than a week, which is the first time we've done that. Amazing Red battles Tyler Breeze for the first time ever. The Rascals, Desmond Xavier and Zachary Wentz, they're going to be taking on Jay Lyon and Midas Black of Main Event, with the winners getting a shot at Matt and Jeff Hardy next month back here in New York for the HOG tag team titles. We've got Mustafa Ali, of course, a Chicago native, taking on Marcus Mathers. Indy Hartwell defends her HOG Women's Championship against Shotzi, who tagged with Scarlett Bordeaux last night. Charles Mason defends his HOG World Championship on the show as well, and more yet to be announced. I will be on the call yet again on Triller TV Plus if my voice holds out. Hopefully it will. We'll see. But hopefully I will get to see some of you in Chicago. It's always a fun time there, especially when we're packed in and sold out at Logan Square Auditorium. So given that that is where I'm going to be on Friday, you could surmise from that that there will be no SmackDown live stream. So just be aware of that. Let's get into the news of the week here, and we'll start with this. WWE announced that next year's Elimination Chamber, while they still have an Elimination Chamber until Mark Shapiro decides to kill it, will be held at the United Center in Chicago. There you go, Chicago, man. I'm telling you, Chicago's a big hub for wrestling. Chicago, and I say this as a native New Yorker my entire life, I can sit here and say that I do believe Chicago, if you had to pick one city that has the best wrestling crowds, it would be Chicago, right? New York is great. There are cities in Canada like Toronto that are great, the UK, but Chicago has got to be number one. And so they are going to bring the Elimination Chamber to Chicago, the home of the Chicago Bulls and the Chicago Blackhawks, on Saturday, February 28th. That's big, because WWE has not run a show of any kind at the United Center in nearly 8 years, and they have not run a major show there since SummerSlam in 1994. That was the very first event that arena ever hosted. And I especially like this. This is a Today in Chicago History item that I found from the Chicago Tribune site from just a few months ago. Breaking the seal on this dolled-up barn was not the Rolling Stones, as originally rumored, but rather the sophisticated artistry of the World Wrestling Federation's SummerSlam 94. And with the three tenors already booked through the upcoming millennium, Bret Hitman Hart, Lex Luger, and The Undertaker seem like the next logical lineup. And in the steel cage match, Hart defeated Owen Hart, and The Undertaker defeated himself. I don't know why that made me laugh so much when I read that for the first time. It just sounds so ridiculous. But I mean, it's classier, I guess, to say that The Undertaker defeated himself than to say The Undertaker beat himself. What better way to break in the new arena than having The Undertaker beat himself in the main event? Oh, man, I'm 5 years old. You know, the bigger story here from the original newspaper article is this. This is legitimately from an article that was done after this original first ever event at the United Center. Other virgin customers who dared to venture out of their seats meandered throughout the boundless confines, trying to find restrooms, exits, and mustard. It took me almost 15 minutes to get two Italian sausages, said a visibly distressed Audrey Donaldson. Then they told me they have no mustard. You expect the high prices, but not bad service. Her son Brandon chimed in. Tell them to get mustard packets so you can fix your food at your seat before it gets cold. You know, it's been 30 years. Hopefully they've addressed the mustard situation by now. But that's one of my favorite matches of all time from that SummerSlam show, the Bret Owen cage match. I don't know that anything on this Elimination Chamber show could possibly top it, but they'll have their chance. Now, I said that it was the first event of any kind there in several years. In 2018, they ran a house show there because the Allstate Arena, where they usually run, was already booked. And that show had a main event of Roman Reigns beating John Cena. That's actually the reason they're running the United Center this time instead of the Allstate Arena, because they already have a Monster Jam freestyle event booked that day. The United Center is the largest indoor arena in the United States. For concerts, it has a capacity of over 23,000. This is going to be less than that if you account for the staging, but you know the way that TKO's been doing things over the last couple of years, if they run a very minimalist stage, they could probably fit pretty close to 20K in that building. And as you would imagine, CM Punk is front and center in the graphic for the show. If he is not defending his world heavyweight title on that show, he will surely be in the Elimination Chamber. I could see him winning the Elimination Chamber. I don't see him winning the Rumble. But if he was to lose the championship between now and then, I much better chance I see him winning the Chamber. Punk has a very unique connection to that arena, because it is the place where he returned to wrestling in 2021 and made his AEW debut, which is still one of the loudest reactions that I have ever heard on a wrestling show. And that is coming from someone who lived through all of those Austin reactions during the Attitude Era. Okay, that Punk return in 2021 was up there in that category. And I have sometimes gotten questions over the years about why WWE always runs Allstate and they never run the United Center. Now, I think it has mostly to do with costs. One of the reasons they don't run Madison Square Garden as often as they used to, and they tend to run the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. You know, it's very expensive to run the United Center relative to whatever the deal is they have with the Allstate Arena. But also, they don't have conflicts with Allstate to worry about like they do with the United Center. They don't have to compete with Bulls games. They don't have to compete with Blackhawks games and whatever the schedule is. And then there's another aspect to this, and this is from what I've been told by some of my Chicago listeners, which is that Allstate is a lot closer to the major airport there than the United Center is. It's only like 3 miles away, so it's just a more convenient option. So if you've ever wondered, well, how come they don't run, you know, the United Center anymore? I think it's a combination of those three things, and when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. But then came this piece of tragic news from WrestleVotes on Friday. I'll be sitting Shiva for the rest of the week, because SmackDown is moving from 2 hours back to 3 hours again, starting with the January 2nd episode from Buffalo, New York. Buffalo, New York. I wonder if West Side Gunn will try to attend. They said that this was a joint decision between WWE and USA Network. And this comes after I threw a party on July 4th when they finally moved the show back to 2 hours. We celebrated our nation's independence and our independence from 3 hour SmackDowns. I just don't believe it. At a time when the show has not been this bad in years, their answer is to expand it. It's to make it longer. It's to give us another hour. And of course, the defenders are out there in full force, who will defend anything this company does to their dying breath. They're already out with the excuses. Well, you know, Solomonster, now they'll have more time for women like Julia and some of the undercard people, and more time for the tag team division. And a tag team division, by the way, that's gone from hot to cold, not because they're not featured enough, but because it's the same teams every week on TV. And they have nothing interesting for them to do. 3 hours is going to do nothing to solve this in and of itself, but evidently they think 3 hours is going to be the magic pill that this show needs. You do realize that this means that it will be an extra hour for them to squeeze in another match with the MFTs each week. You do realize it's another hour for them to squeeze in a whole bunch of commercials. The problem with SmackDown is not that the matches are too short, although some of them are. The problem with SmackDown is that the show just isn't interesting. The problem with SmackDown is that they haven't even bothered to truly shake up the roster in over a year. The problem with SmackDown is that certain top names vanish for months on end. So you tell me, how does adding a third hour to this show do anything to solve any of those problems that I just mentioned? It doesn't. But if they insist on expanding the show back to 3 hours, and I stand firm in my belief that there is no weekly wrestling show that needs to be 3 hours long. I don't give a shit what company it is. I don't care how good the show is. I don't care how bad the show is. You feel it more when the show sucks. But I absolutely hate this belief that some fans have, and probably because it's what they grew up with as a wrestling fan, that the shows need to be 3 hours long. This is the norm. It has to be 3 hours long so you can get everybody on the show every single week and you can tell stories the right way. Motherfucker, if you can't write a good, compelling television show in 2 hours and you feel the need to have 3 hours in order to do that, then you are doing it wrong. Because last I checked, they had a brand split. So their giant roster is split in half between Mondays and Fridays. And I know there's a lot of overlap and they ignore their own rules, but still, there is a brand split in place. And 2 hours should be plenty of time to feature all of the people that you need to feature, even if that means not everybody can be on the show every single week. That's okay. It's okay if you skip a week here and there. Not everybody has to be on the show every single week. But I watched wrestling for years and years, and I saw lots of good wrestling shows that were a hell of a lot less than 3 hours long. The length of time is not the, I mean, it is an issue when it's too long, but the length of time is not the issue here. The issue is with the writing of these shows and the booking of the talent on these shows, the way they utilize some of the talent on these shows. Let's just say it isn't always up to par. Adding another hour to the show does not make the show better. All you're doing is adding another hour of shit. But if they insist on doing this, there are moves that are going to have to be made. Now, I'm sure that they are doing this for WrestleMania season, right? Now, TC from WrestleVote says the move to 3 hours is at least through June. So it's not going to go, you know, 3 months, 4 months, and then go back to the way it was. It's going to go beyond WrestleMania. That's what happened this year. It didn't go back to 2 hours until the beginning of July. But I'm sure Mania season is the impetus for this, right? That, and they love torturing me. But there are serious changes that are going to have to be made to that show, whether it goes 3 hours or they keep it at 2 hours. So now we're getting into a discussion here about SmackDown in general. This actually doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with 3 hours. There are serious changes that need to be made to this show. Getting Jacob Fatu back will help. Getting Bianca Belair back eventually will help. And Randy Orton. But they need to swap certain people out and swap other people in, and they need to make some roster moves. That's number one. Number two, they need to continue calling up new faces from NXT. Lash Legend is not enough. Number three, if they continue with this MFT stuff, I'm going to need a reason to care about these men. Right now, I have none. And you want to know what would get the MFTs over? Yeah, I watched Rey Fénix splat on the ground outside on Friday when he did that corkscrew dive out onto the floor, onto the MFTs. Nobody caught him. Tongaloa was standing right there. He didn't catch him. We have seen Solo Sikoa acting goofy sometimes. He's a funny guy. He's got personality. Sometimes he shows it. Sometimes they force him to try to be serious, and it just doesn't work. I just want it to be entertaining. I have nothing against any of these men personally. It's their presentation and the characters and the way that they are utilized and presented on television. It is not entertaining. I just want it to be entertaining. I will never take these guys seriously in their current incarnation. I cannot do it. But if they lean into them as the gang that can't shoot straight, if they lean into them like a bunch of tryhards, but they fall flat on their faces each time and Solo has a meltdown, right? That would be funny. That would be entertaining. And they would still be heels, but if you do that for a few months and you inject some humor into it and give us more interactions between the members, or maybe it's Tongaloa who always screws things up and they clown on him for it. Tama Tonga, though, acts all protective since it's his brother. Tala Tonga becomes the giant with a big heart, you know, who can't control his temper and just smashes people and sticks up for his family. Like, they each develop a personality of their own. I guarantee you, if you play this right, within a few months, they are going to be super over as babyfaces. I promise you. And it sounds counterintuitive, but I think to get people to take these guys more seriously and invest in them, you have to go all the way and turn them into a complete joke. If you play it right, I think it pays off with an act that's actually over, and you'll get more out of them on the back end as fan favorites than you will as heels. But use that extra time to really develop some of these characters, and not just the MFTs. I mean, this applies to everybody on the roster, top to bottom. You know, learn from what made SmackDown the A show there a few years ago. Kicking the can down the road and giving us more of the same is not the answer. They're lucky they have the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania coming up, because that tends to get people more excited. It's the most exciting time of year for the WWE product. Although the build to WrestleMania this year tells us that's not always a good thing. But SmackDown has been low effort, boring television. And that needs to change, especially if you're going to give us more of it. 3 hours of the show in its current state benefits no one. No one except USA Network, which gets an extra hour of content. It benefits no one else if changes aren't made. And really what they're getting is an extra 30 minutes or so, because the rest of it is going to be commercials. But take those extra 30 minutes and make the most of it. Today's episode is sponsored by Hims. Guys, if you're suffering from hair loss, you've probably tried something, or maybe multiple things, to find that magic potion to get your hair back. And if you're listening to this and you're like, hey, that's me, then this is for you. So listen up. You can forget all the trial and error, all the searching, like you're looking for buried treasure. What works for hair loss has been staring you right in the face this entire time. With Hims, you get access to clear solutions, expert guidance, and an online process that takes the confusion out of care. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medications, serums, and sprays. Doctor-trusted, clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil can stop further hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. No hidden fees, no surprise costs, just real personalized care on your own schedule. You can think of Hims as your digital front door that you walk through to be transported back to your old self. With 100% online access to trusted treatments for real health concerns, all in one place. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit Hims.com/Solomonster. That's Hims.com/Solomonster for your free online visit. Hims.com/Solomonster. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. John Cena got his Boston farewell on Raw Monday night with a match against Dominic Mysterio, who interrupted the opening segment and talked his way right into what he did not want, which was an Intercontinental title match. And they had a very basic match, but it was exactly what it needed to be. They didn't have to do much. They had that crowd eating up everything they did. And it was a huge spot for Dom to be in, even in the promo. Like, he just looked cool as a cucumber. Like, he knew he belonged in that spot. And then he got to wrestle John Cena in one of his last matches. And he lost. And that's okay. I think some people are making too big of a deal about the fact that he lost this match. It was about the moment. You know, people wanted to see John Cena win the Grand Slam. The Intercontinental title was the only one that he did not have, and now he does. And so John Cena is the new Intercontinental champion. He also announced that one request that he made, and he doesn't usually make requests, but he requested that they host a series of WWE versus NXT exhibitions, as he called them, as part of his final night on Saturday night's main event. This was legitimately a John Cena call. It's something that he wanted on his final show. He wanted to do, you know, something where the show would double as a showcase for NXT talent. Because he's paid a few visits recently to the Performance Center, and he was very impressed by what he saw. He was also spotted visiting the Dungeon with Natty and TJ Wilson and all of their students. The guy wants to give back, and this is his way of doing so. I don't know what the matches are going to be, but I think you want to showcase your best names from that brand. You know, we know Oba Femi is not going to be in this Last Time Is Now tournament unless he ends up as the mystery entrant on Raw tomorrow night, which I don't think he will be. Let's assume he's not going to be in this tournament. He also just returned at the very end of Tuesday's NXT episode, so he is not done with Ricky Saints yet. Oba Femi should absolutely get a match or spotlight of some kind on that show. He's going to be a major player for them in 2026 on the main roster. Ricky Saints is the NXT champion. He needs to have a match on that show. And hell, why not Cody Rhodes? Yeah, champion against champion. They're good friends. I'm sure Cody would love to work with Ricky. He would give him a lot. Ricky loses that fight. Absolutely. But losing to the top guy in the company is not a bad thing if you go out there and have a competitive match with him. Or CM Punk, right? Ricky is tight with both those guys. Either one of those matches would be a good option. Trick Williams, Javon Evans, Blake Monroe, Kendall Gray. Kendall Gray is the Evolve Women's Champion, but they're said to be very high on her potential. Why not showcase her in a spot on that show? Now, as far as the tournament is concerned and Cena's final opponent, Gunther still looks to be the favorite. They announced that he will be back on Raw tomorrow night from Madison Square Garden against Javon Evans. And that is the thing that I am most looking forward to about any of the shows this week. That is the match that I pitched as the final of this tournament a few weeks ago, and we're getting it in the opening round instead, and that's okay. I'm just happy that we're getting it at all, because I think that match is going to kick ass. Now, if they want to book the biggest upset since Razor and the Kid back in 93, it's right there, but I don't think they have the guts to do it. Rusev, Sheamus, Jey Uso, LA Knight, they have all advanced to the next round, although without a bracket, we still don't know who's facing who yet. Rusev against Sheamus and LA Knight against Jey Uso, it would all make sense, but we've already seen those matches. We're not done yet, though, because tomorrow night, in addition to Gunther against Javon Evans, Solo Sikoa faces a mystery opponent. And on SmackDown this Friday, it's Carmelo Hayes against Big Bronson Reed, and Finn Balor takes on Penta. And that's it. That's the entire first round. LA Knight beat Zack Ryder on Friday night. Under that name, he was Matt Cardona on NXT a few weeks ago, but here he's back to Zack Ryder. Even though he has said in the past, Zack Ryder is dead, and if it were up to him and he went back to WWE, he would be Matt Cardona. Evidently, it was not up to him, and I guess they wanted him back as Zack Ryder because Zack Ryder is the one who has history with John Cena. But it's still silly to go from one name and one gimmick on your television show to a completely different one a few weeks later. But you know what? Good for him. Cardona has been killing it on the indies for years. I know that he has been waiting for that phone call to go back there. This does not mean that he is back full time. This does not mean he has signed a contract with them. For now, it is just a one-off appearance. Now, they do have Zack Ryder merchandise back up on WWE Shop. And Fightful is saying that's because he signed a merch deal with them. But that's the only thing that he has signed. Under no circumstance, though, should he have been beating LA Knight in this tournament. So that was the right call. And it's sad that we've gotten to a point where when LA Knight wins a match like this, I'm actually pleasantly surprised. That's sad. And the final surprise will come at MSG tomorrow, and it is very likely going to be Joe Hendry. Joe Hendry is officially a WWE superstar. Per Fightful Select, he has reportedly signed a full-time contract with the company, which I think most people predicted was going to be the case. But this is even though his TNA deal was not set to expire for a little bit. PW Insider said the end of December. He used representation to move forward with WWE. Now, if I'm TNA, I know we have this partnership with the company. It really, it's more of an NXT partnership than anything else. But, you know, we saw Joe Hendry in the Rumble. We saw Joe Hendry get that spot against Randy Orton at WrestleMania when Kevin Owens had to be pulled because of the neck injury. If I'm TNA, I'm asking for one thing in return for allowing you to sign this man early, even though he was still under contract to our company. And I am requesting an AJ Styles match in return for letting Joe out of his deal. I think it's only fair. Styles doesn't seem to think another match in TNA is going to happen. He said that this week. But that's what I would have asked for. Right, we'll let you have him early. Just commit to letting us use Styles for one match at some point next year. I don't think that's too much to ask. Or maybe they did and they were rejected. But that's what I would have asked for. Hendry has been trying to manifest a match with John Cena all year. He said he spoke to Cena about it back at the Royal Rumble, and Cena's answer to him was very simple. He said, if you can manifest it and make it happen, then do it. I would love it. But Cena wasn't going to lobby for it or anything like that. And then the last few months, no one was really talking about it. You know, it kind of felt like that idea had grown cold. But now, if he ends up in this tournament, he at least has a shot. I cannot see him in a tournament that has Gunther in it and Joe Hendry winning over Gunther. I don't see that. I actually think he's got a much better shot at getting a match with John Cena And this is my idea for how they could go with it. He's going to be on the NXT roster from what we are reading. So this may be pie in the sky. But John Cena has confirmed that he will be wrestling tomorrow night. That's going to be his last Raw match ever. 544 matches on Raw, the most in history, he says. I'm not so sure that that is entirely accurate. Randy Orton teased him about it on X. It may be Randy Orton. I don't know. Randy Orton, by the way, is being advertised for the December 5th episode of SmackDown in Austin, Texas. So he is finally on his way back soon. But it is not that hard to envision John Cena coming out tomorrow night and saying, you know, in the spirit of the open challenges that I started when I was the United States champion 10 years ago, I would like to do the same with the Intercontinental title, with the limited time that I have left. Because he's all about opportunity, right? That's all he talks about is, you know, paying it forward and giving opportunities to the next generation. So in his final match at Madison Square Garden, we're going to have the Intercontinental Championship Open Challenge. And that's when they hit the music, and out comes Joe Hendry, making his MSG debut to challenge John Cena for the title. And if he wins it, what a debut for him, and you start him on the main roster. If he doesn't win it, still, what a debut for him, and then you can keep him in NXT. He's actually wrestling the following night at the theater at Madison Square Garden on the NXT Gold Rush show. He's teaming with Thea Hale against Ethan Page and Chelsea Green for the AAA Mixed Tag Team titles. But if Gunther is winning that tournament, then John Cena does not need to be the champion heading into December 13th. If he does not drop it tomorrow, let him do another open challenge at Survivor Series and drop it to somebody in San Diego. Right? But Cena just won this title, right? And we know he's wrestling on the show tomorrow. An open challenge would make sense. Unless they just have Dominic come out to accept, you know, the open challenge and he wins the belt back, which, you know, I mean, that works too, you know, and Dom gets his win back, he gets his belt back, and the only reason they did what they did this week with John Cena was to give the fans in Boston a big moment and to give him the Grand Slam. And then the belt goes right back to Dom. I kind of feel like in his final Raw match, though, that would be a little underwhelming, especially when you know that, you know, he's not going to win the belt back without the Judgment Day or El Grande Americano getting involved and helping him or some bullshit like that. But that's tomorrow night. For Friday, let me talk about this real quick. You know, people are going to laugh at the idea of Carmelo Hayes beating Bronson Reed. I actually think he's got a really good chance of advancing in this tournament just because of the way the show ended on Friday. They had a WWE Championship match between Cody Rhodes and Bronson Reed. Paul Heyman set the trap earlier in the show. Cody took the bait, and he convinced him to make it a title match. And for some reason, Paul Heyman didn't seem to be too bothered when Bron Breakker and Logan Paul ran in to cause the disqualification and ruin their chances of winning the WWE Championship that he asked for. He's the one who pitched the idea of, hey, why don't you make this a title match? And Cody was like, okay, that's a great idea. Nick, make the match. And that's how we ended up with a WWE Championship match. Paul Heyman didn't seem too bothered by it. Bronson Reed didn't seem too bothered by it either. None of that made any sense. But what happened at the end of the show was Reed squashed Cody with a tsunami splash. So I think it's very likely that Bronson Reed is going to get bounced. He's going to get his comeuppance. And that may be the big upset of the tournament. You got to have at least one. You have to have at least one upset. If Javon Evans is not upsetting Gunther tomorrow night, then I think you have Carmelo Hayes eke out a win over Bronson Reed. Now, he's not going to look very strong at all if Bronson Reed just dominates him for 10 minutes and then he only, you know, wins the match because Cody gets involved. But a win is a win, and he would advance to the next round. And then with Balor and Penta, there's a reason that I call him Pin Balor. I don't see why this would be any different. I think that should be a win for Penta. We had a lot of developments this week on the War Games front for the men's and women's teams. It will be 5-on-5, in case anybody was wondering if they might shoot for 4-on-4 this year. The answer is no. Cody Rhodes will be in War Games, and if Cody is in War Games, then it only makes sense that Drew McIntyre is in War Games as well. Right now, it is CM Punk, Cody Rhodes, and the Usos. They are all official on the babyface side. Roman Reigns said that he did not want to see his cousins until Christmas. But I think he's showing up in Madison Square Garden tomorrow. And, you know, I was talking to Noah Mark, our old pal Noah, and he pointed out that Roman had a total of 6 matches last year. And he has had a total of 6 matches so far this year. And him telling the Usos that he doesn't want to see them until Christmas, you know, he was thinking that maybe he's contracted to a specific number of matches each year, right? As is the case, I'm sure, with Brock Lesnar, probably. So he won't be at Survivor Series, and we won't see him in the ring again probably until the Royal Rumble. And it's an interesting theory. So I can't say that it would be impossible to conceive that Roman is contracted to a specific number of matches each year. Maybe he has hit his quota and that's it for him in 2025. I still say he shows up tomorrow night, but it's an interesting theory. Now, if it is not Roman, it could still be John Cena or someone else like LA Knight. And then they do the idea that I pitched a few weeks ago where Jimmy or LA Knight gets taken out the week before. It's like, oh my God, who's going to be the fifth man? And then it ends up being John Cena as a surprise, because we know Cena will be at Survivor Series. We just don't know what he's doing yet. Cena being in there actually kind of makes sense if Brock Lesnar is going to round out the heel side. The only thing with that idea is that right now they're doing the exact same angle with the women after Charlotte Flair refused to team with Rhea Ripley and she walked out of SmackDown on Friday. So I don't know about running the same angle in both matches. The heel side now has Bron Breakker, Bronson Reed, Logan Paul, and Drew McIntyre, with one spot left open that should be the Brock spot. McIntyre returned on Friday night. Nick Aldis was not happy about this. The reason he was back 1 week after being suspended by Aldis was because in the War Games contract, Paul Heyman pointed out earlier in the show, I could sign anyone from any brand to join our team, even a SmackDown star. That SmackDown star turned out to be Drew McIntyre. So that's their way of circumventing the suspension, which honestly you would think would resume after War Games. I mean, why would Nick Aldis not continue the suspension? Suspension of disbelief, that's why. They want you to check your brain at the door with this stuff. The Kabuki Warriors, they won the women's tag team titles from Charlotte Flair and Alexa Bliss on Monday night. Then Rhea Ripley and Io Sky came out to make the save after the match, so it looked to be Rhea, Io, Charlotte, Alexa, and a fifth woman on the babyface side. Until they all got in the ring together on Friday, and Charlotte said, I can't do this anymore. She said, Rhea, I don't like you. I don't trust you. You're a snake. I can't forget the history that we have together. And she said, Lexi, you can do this if you want, but I'm out. And she left. So they're building drama because now the babyfaces are two women short, right? What are they going to do? The heels have Asuka, Kairi, Nia Jax, Lash Legend. My guess is Becky Lynch rounds out the five. And on the other side, Charlotte eventually has a change of heart and rejoins them. And the fifth spot goes to AJ Lee, who I think shows up to Madison Square Garden tomorrow night. We know AJ's in New York because she was at the big event yesterday. Boy, she had the longest line of anybody at the big event. Long after the event was supposed to be over, there was still a long-ass line for AJ Lee. So I don't know if she flew right back to Chicago or not, but at least as of yesterday, we know she's in New York. I'm just saying that makes it a little easier to believe that she may be at Madison Square Garden tomorrow. But Becky on that show tomorrow is defending her Intercontinental title against Maxine Dupri. Having Maxine in the War Games match, you know, it doesn't pack quite the same punch as AJ being in there. I don't think any of this is leading to a Charlotte heel turn, by the way, you know, just because they need Charlotte as a babyface to work with Jade Cargill. Like, Jade needs challengers. Alexa Bliss and Charlotte Flair are two people for her to work with, especially now they don't have those tag team titles anymore. You have to keep them babyface at least for a few more months. Bayley and Lyra, they drew the short stick here because they've had their issues with Asuka and Kairi, and they have no spot in War Games unless Charlotte really is out. And then the last two spots go to Bayley and Lyra. But if Becky is joining the heel side, it really has to be someone on the opposing side that she's been, you know, beefing with recently. And her feud with Bayley and Lyra, that's months old at this point. But we're actually getting a traditional Survivor Series elimination style match this year. We haven't had one in a while. We have the MFTs against Sami Zayn, Rey Fénix, Shinsuke Nakamura, and the Motor City Machine Guns on SmackDown. Yes, the night before Survivor Series. We are getting a traditional Survivor Series elimination match. Yeah, I can't be too upset that they're doing it on TV instead of on the PLE because it's the MFTs. So I'm not going to be sad they're not on the big show, but at least we're getting an elimination match this year. I think they should shoot to do one every year. The only thing is we are going to have to deal with three or four commercial breaks during the match. That's the thing that sucks about it being on TV. Unless, of course, you're using your ExpressVPN like this guy here. Then you don't have to worry about that. Now, on the TNA front, we had another example this week of LOL TNA, which has lived on really for the entire 18 years that I've been doing this podcast. You can find plenty of LOL TNA moments over the years. And as TNA has evolved and changed and come under new ownership, and they've even created some buzz around the product in recent months, we're still waiting for word on what this new TV deal is going to be. It's almost December already. Carlos Silva said that, you know, it was going to have to be a deal that kicked off at the beginning of 2026, so we're still waiting on that. But for all of that, one thing remains consistent. One thing will live on forever, and that is LOL TNA. Because this week, Mike Santana, who just had his big crowning moment at Bound for Glory, right, less than a month ago, and became the TNA World Heavyweight Champion after a struggle that lasted most of this year, Mike Santana is no longer the TNA World Heavyweight Champion because Frankie Kazarian, during Thursday night's Live Impact episode, defeated Santana by cashing in his Call Your Shot Gauntlet trophy that he won at, actually co-won with Nick Nemeth at Bound for Glory. Santana made his one and only defense of the TNA World Championship on Thursday's episode. He beat Ryan Nemeth. It was some kind of, I don't know, no contest or DQ, whatever it was, when a group of NXT stars, and I use that word loosely, ran in and attacked Santana during the match, and they went after the arm. And after the ring cleared, Kazarian cashed in his trophy and became the sixth Grand Slam champion in TNA history. Boy, we had a lot of Grand Slam history made this week, didn't we, in wrestling? So they took a month off. TNA had no shows, okay, for an entire month. And they came back with this TV taping. They actually taped at Full Sail University on Thursday. And you have Lexus King, and you have Charlie Dempsey and Robert Stone, and you have Stax and Brooks Jensen from NXT, the NXT B team, run in to attack Mike Santana and injure him. This was LOL TNA in every way, because even the way he lost, Santana lost the championship in the worst possible way. After the company takes a month off, the first night he defends that championship, he gets attacked by these guys. They stomp on the arm. Kazarian cashes in. Santana go in the second match here after, you know, Kazarian cashed in. Santana's going for the spin the block lariat, but he stops. He gets a cramp in his arm, and he gets rolled up. That is how he lost the title. And you can call it, well, it was arm pain. I'm going to call it a cramp. He lost his championship on account of a cramp. And Mike Santana's reign, think about this, as TNA World Champion, his first reign ends with his only other television appearance being a match with Cedric Alexander a few weeks ago, where he did not even bring the belt out with him to the ring because the match was taped the month before he won the belt. And now they're trying to build drama around this, and this is only making the situation worse, because per PW Insider on Friday, this was quite the drama over the course of the day, because they said as of 2 p.m. Eastern this afternoon, Mike Santana has not arrived at tonight's TNA Turning Point pay-per-view. Call time for talent was 1 p.m. Eastern. Santana, who dropped the title last night to Frankie Kazarian, did not appear for his scheduled meet-and-greet after the taping. The word making the way around talents is that Santana has not returned the company's phone calls or texts. TNA officials did not return a request for comment, and they said Santana is slated to work tonight's pay-per-view main event, teaming with Steve Maclin against Kazarian and Nick Nemeth. And then later in the day on Friday, PW Insider follows up and says, Santana's current TNA deal is up at the end of the year. The belief is that he has an offer on the table from TNA for an extension. There has been WWE interest in Santana dating back months, but obviously the two sides work together, and it's entirely conceivable that they will work together as they did with Joe Hendry. There has been an assumption from some that last night's angle with Santana losing the title was to facilitate him leaving for NXT, but no one on the WWE side has confirmed that that was the case. Then came Sean Ross Sapp later on, who tweeted, "The Santana thing is a work. Don't know how else to put it. TNA should have probably just posted that on their Twitter instead of feeding it to media like it was real. That's a no-go for me. First time an official in any company has done that with us." So they tried to pass this thing off as a shoot where, oh, he's been unreachable and he's ignoring the company's phone calls and texts and Santana's angry and this is all very, very dumb. If this is all some angle, this is all some kind of work, this is so stupid. So like in storyline, why would Mike Santana be mad at TNA management and ghost them? Because they let Kazarian cash in on him after he was attacked by the B team? That's what the Call Your Shot trophy is for. It's their version of Money in the Bank. Right? Played out as it is. Why would he be mad at them for that? Like, everything about this is just so fucking dumb. And I'll tell you what, like, my guess is that Santana is probably going to stick around for a while longer with TNA. You know, he knows, I'm sure, that he can appear on NXT if they call upon him. It's good that they have that partnership. Mike Santana absolutely belongs in NXT. If NXT is the kind of the first, you know, entry point for him to eventually get to the main roster, he is more than ready to be on Raw or SmackDown. But Mike Santana belongs in NXT. You know, he should be in there wrestling guys like Ricky Saints and Obafemi on a regular basis. If he wants to stay with TNA, that's his decision to make. But I just think ending his first championship run, and he'll likely win it back. And everybody will be like, oh, see, you know, he won it back. Yeah, that's not the point, though. For him to go in there after all these months and win the championship and to take it from him in the most anticlimactic, just like Bush League way possible is just incredibly stupid, where they're trying to work some kind of weird work shoot angle that really is not entertaining and it's not going to generate any new interest in the product or bring in any new fans. It's just going to piss off and alienate the people who already watch the product or cover the product. Doesn't do anything for Mike Santana. It doesn't do anything for Frankie Kazarian. It doesn't do anything for TNA. Just stupid.
Who are these mystery opponents in the Last Time Is Now John Cena tournament? Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet, and I'm breaking that down on my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet, this week. I also just had one of my favorite interviews of the year with the legend himself, Mick Foley. Some other recent guests include Io Sky, Stephanie Vaquer, Joe Hendry, Shawn Michaels, Rhea Ripley, Samoa Joe, and many others. You can find Insight with Chris Van Vliet on Spotify or Apple or wherever you're listening to this right now, or just search for Chris Van Vliet on YouTube.
Again, it was good to see Chris at the big event yesterday. And yeah, you see a lot of his content on YouTube, a lot of the full video interviews and the clips. But some people don't realize that the audio versions are available as well. He's got audio shows. So definitely go ahead and give those a listen and drop him a note. Drop him a tweet and let him know that you heard about the shows here on the Sound Off. On his recent episode of Talk Is Jericho, Chris Jericho made a comment that got a lot of people talking. And he had an episode with the Hardys and the Dudleys discussing their match from TNA Bound for Glory this year. And Jericho was praising the match and the presentation, really, of the entire pay-per-view, saying that TNA looked like the second biggest company in the world that night. Yes. He said, "I don't think I've watched an Impact, a TNA match in ages, if not this decade at all. I was so impressed," Jericho said. "Well, first of all, you guys had a match." Yeah, no shit. It wasn't even the match. It was the beginning part before you guys even locked up. It was the end part after it happened. Like that. I'm getting a little goosebumps. That's pro wrestling in its ultimate form. That's all that matters is that emotion and that reaction. That was one thing. Two, that fucking crowd looked huge. It looked huge. It was like a WWE level crowd. The place was packed. I was watching this, and Not saying anything out of school here, but comparing it to watching Dynamite when they were at the ECW arena, which looked like a Tony Condello taping. Sorry, it did. TNA looked like the second biggest company in the world, and that was amazing. And the presentation was amazing. Yeah, he's gone. I mean, I think most people probably assumed he was gone anyway. I don't think that he's taken most of this year off, right? He's been off television since, what, April? I don't think he's taken most of this year off just to go right back to AEW. But if you didn't believe it before, you can believe it now that Chris Jericho is just preparing for that Royal Rumble return, I'm sure. But I expect him back in WWE in the next few months. AJ Styles was on a podcast, not Chris Jericho's podcast, although he may well be wrestling him at some point next year. But AJ Styles was on a podcast, the No Contest Wrestling Podcast, talking about the lack of quality selling in wrestling today. He said he would like to see the industry return to a less is more type of approach. He said, I can tell you one thing that's missing, and I still to this day, I will go over to my buddy's house before we work out, and we'll watch old school wrestling. It's what we do. That's kind of our thing. And the one thing I think is missing the most is selling. When he was asked to respond to name one thing that is missing in the modern wrestling era, he said the way they used to sell back in the day, man, they really made you believe that this hurt, that this guy's in pain. And I just feel like we've gotten away from that. And I'm just as guilty as anybody. But if we could take it back and make it a less is more kind of thing, I think that would be best for everybody. And naturally, he's going to say that. The man is 48 years old who wrestled a very high risk aerial style for a large swath of his career. And I'm sure he's feeling pretty beat up. And I'm sure he recognizes that as you get older, as someone who is the crusty old veteran now in the wrestling business, that, you know what? Maybe it's not always the smartest thing to go out there, balls to the wall, and do all of this risky, crazy, dangerous stuff. Maybe sometimes you could just slow things down a little bit. You do a little bit less, but you get more out of it. And that probably is something that comes with just experience and time. Because when you're young, like some of these guys in NXT, you're a Leon Slater in TNA, you're a Javon Evans going out there, 20 years old, 21 years old. You use the tools that you have, right? Javon Evans is not a big guy. He's not going to go out there and work a big man match. He's a lightweight, right? He's not exactly muscled up or anything like that. So he's going to use that to his advantage. He's going to fly. He's going to do things that dazzle you and make you go, holy shit, I can't believe he just did that. That's what made the match with him and Leon Slater so much fun to watch, because their styles are so similar. Their body types are so similar, and two of the best in the world at what they do right now. So they went out there and had this great match. But you do all of these moves and these dives and you take these incredible risks. And at what point do you just go, how do you top this? Like, where do you go from here? It's just the natural question to ask. And this has been the age-old question in wrestling. This is not like a new phenomenon here. I'm just using them as an example. But I 100%, as a fan watching the shows, I 100% agree with AJ Styles. Although I will say, you watch SmackDown each week, you've got Ilya Dragunov out there every week selling his ass off like he's on the verge of death in every match. Sometimes he may go a little over the top with it, but I appreciate the way that he sells in his matches. Dragunov is one of the few, honestly, in wrestling today who can still sell in a way that is similar to a Bret Hart. And to me, Bret Hart will always be the master at it. There's a reason why Gorilla Monsoon started calling him the excellence of execution. Bret Hart was the best when it came to selling a beating in a wrestling match and making it look as realistic as possible. When he was in there and he was, you know, down on the mat, thrown into the turnbuckles, taking that chest bump in the corner when the heel was working him over, you felt like this was a battle. This was a struggle for him. He was fighting for his life in there. And that type of selling is virtually non-existent in wrestling these days. And I'll throw one more thing in there, and AJ didn't mention this, but I've brought this up before. I don't understand why we don't have that many wrestlers in wrestling today, it just feels like to me, who know how to throw a punch like those guys did back in the day. I can list off, and Bret's one of those guys, but Steve Austin and Scott Hall and Jeff Jarrett and Jerry Lawler, there are certain people who, when they would throw like a closed fist and they would throw a work punch at a wrestling match, it looked devastating. It looked like they were really punching the guy in the fucking face. And I just feel like we don't have as much of that in wrestling now. And part of it is the fact that a lot of guys will throw forearms, which I think is something that I first started noticing that watching New Japan. I think it's a Japanese thing, you know, strong style. I guess the logic behind it is, well, you don't want to break your hand, so you throw a forearm. So you can explain it in that fashion. But there's a lot of wrestlers who will do that now. We have these forearm battles and these chop battles, yay, boo, all this stuff. But just throwing a simple punch, I think, is a lost art. It really is. But the art of selling is so important in the course of a wrestling match. That's how you tell a story. You tell a story through the way that you are selling in the course of the match. And if you're going to make a big heroic comeback, that's part of the story that you're telling. So AJ is 100% bang on in that. I think part of it, I don't want to excuse the talent. You know, the talent is guilty of it. AJ himself said, I'm guilty of it. But also, it's, I think, just the nature of wrestling television now, where everything is just, there's this sense of urgency and the pace has been picked up so much. And you've got to go from one to the other to the other. And the way these matches are constructed, and I see it a lot watching AEW, where it's just spot, 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 right? We got to go from one big spot to the next. And you don't leave any time for selling. And it's not just an AEW thing. But I notice it a lot watching Dynamite week to week or the pay-per-views. And you just do this big spot. But I'll tell you what, I'll give you a WWE example. And I'll use Ilya Dragunov and the match that he just had with Axiom. So they just had this United States Championship Open Challenge on Friday. And Axiom did this great move where he did a backflip off the ropes while he was holding Dragunov's arm. And he caught Dragunov on the way down with this spike DDT. And it looked fantastic, right? This great fucking move. And of course, you know, he didn't win the match with it. But shortly thereafter, we had a top rope Spanish fly spot. And Axiom hit a top rope Spanish fly. And went immediately after that, he went to go set it for his finisher, which is the Golden Ratio. And Dragunov caught him with a torpedo Moscow coming out of the corner and headbutted him right in the fucking face. Or chest, or whatever it was. And it looked great. It was a great closing sequence, and it got the fans into it. But you know what? I'm watching this, and I said this on Friday. I'm like, boy, the top rope Spanish fly really doesn't mean what it used to. That's just one example of these big moves that these guys do, and it just, it's a setup move. Or it sets up a near fall, and the match just keeps going. That's why I love how Penta, when he left AEW and came to WWE, they at least have really taken great pains to make the Destroyer a finishing move. It is no longer just a setup move. It's not just another move. It's a move he actually wins matches with, and I appreciate that. But it just goes to this problem that I've noticed in wrestling today, and maybe if you're a newer fan, you don't see it as a problem because you have no concept of what wrestling used to be like. To you, this is what wrestling is. It's balls to the wall, nonstop, boom, 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 spot, 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 and anything else is boring. Oh, this guy, why is he on the mat? He's just laying there. He's making faces. Fucking boring. Some people don't like that. But I'm with AJ on this one. I think it's definitely something that has become a lost art because I feel like wrestlers are too afraid to slow the pace of the match down. I think they're too afraid to slow the pace of the match down. I think there are definitely, absolutely some wrestlers out there who pay too much attention to social media and social media comments. And they don't want to log on and scroll through their timeline and see, oh, this match sucked. This match was boring. This match was slow. This match was dull. And there are matches that are just a little too slow paced, right? You just got to find that happy medium. But I think that's part of the problem. And there's just this constant need to, okay, we got to keep things moving here. We got to do the, you know, another big move because we don't want to lose the crowd and we want to get those chants. We don't want them to, you know, lose interest in what we're doing here. And it's just a different way of doing things, you know, than it was back in the day. You can borrow from the old school on certain things. Not everything has to be old school. Things change. Things evolve. But there is a lot from the old school that I think if you were to educate and condition the current audience that this is the way it should be, they would buy into it. And I think it would really help the product a lot. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. One thing I hate about the fall season is how it gets darker earlier. Makes me feel like I somehow have fewer hours in the day to get stuff done. And honestly, I just find it to be depressing when I look out the window at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and it's pitch black outside. But it really can have a negative effect on your mental state. That's why all November long, BetterHelp is encouraging you to reach out, whether it be to reconnect with an old friend that you haven't spoken to in forever, or to check in on a family member, to remind the people in your life that you're there and they're not alone. And just like it takes courage to send that message or make that phone call, seeking out help in the form of therapy can feel intimidating also, but it's worth it. You'll be asking yourself, man, how come I didn't do this sooner? Finding the right therapist can be life-changing, and BetterHelp makes that process simple. They do the initial matching work for you so that you can focus on your therapy goals. All you do is fill out a short questionnaire, which helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate mean they usually get it right the first time. But if for any reason you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. And all BetterHelp therapists are fully licensed in the U.S., adhering to a strict code of conduct in all the work they do. As the world's largest online therapy platform with over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on more than 1.7 million client reviews. The numbers speak for themselves. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Solomonster listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/solomonster. That's betterhelp.com/solomonster. Wednesday night was AEW's big blood and gut show from Greensboro, which shot up to 600,000 viewers on TBS. That's up almost 21% from the previous week. It's the first time they've touched 600K since September, and that was under the old Nielsen system. The numbers for wrestling across the board have been down under the new methodology, so there was definitely interest in this show. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat made a cameo on the show with his history in Greensboro, and he shot an angle with FTR where they roughed him up a little bit until Brodito came out to make the save. And Ricky tagged him with a few shots of his own. Not bad for 72. Ric Flair, on the other hand, did not make it onto TV, even though he was there. Tony Khan brought him out before the show to address the live crowd, but he left right after as he was said to be in a ton of pain from a rotator cuff tear. I said watching that segment, this feels like Flair was supposed to be out there. It felt like it was planned for both of them, so it was strange that he didn't make an appearance. I mean, not that I needed him on the show, but it just felt like this segment was designed for him to be there, and then all of a sudden he wasn't. You know, if you wanted blood, you got plenty of blood on the show. One thing you cannot say is that when AEW does this stipulation, they don't go far enough, right? Why don't they go all the way with it? Why don't they take full advantage of it? When you have a blood and gut show, AEW will give you more than enough blood. So you definitely got that. But there was a lot. My biggest criticism, honestly, of these matches, if I had to boil it down to one, and it was more of an issue in the men's match, but my issue is that you have this cage that is covering these two rings. And the idea of blood and guts is that you're trapped inside the cage and you just go in there and kill each other. And you know, and we've seen it in past blood and guts matches and, you know, other maybe war games matches sometimes where people will end up brawling outside the cage. But this was just out of control on Wednesday night. There was so much shit going on outside the cage that it was very dumb. I think they overdid it on all of the action that took place outside the actual cage, which to me defeats the entire purpose of what Blood and Guts is supposed to be. So that would be my biggest criticism of it. But otherwise, I think the two matches delivered exactly what you were looking for. If this was something that you were looking forward to seeing, if you were looking forward to Blood and Guts and you wanted hardcore violence and weapons and all kinds of crazy insanity, you got it. You know, you got it on this show. We had the first ever women's Blood and Guts match. They went 45 minutes, and they clearly went out there with something to prove. Every woman, I thought, at one point or another in this match had a chance to shine. They had some kind of moment or spot or something, you know, to try to let them stand out. You had a lot of blood. You had a lot of broken glass, which is really just another Wednesday in AEW. Sky Blue was in there first. She was one of the first people in the match. And in the first probably 4 minutes of the match, if that, she was bleeding. And when I say she was bleeding. Like, the blood was gushing out of the top of her head. And what happened to cause that was just so lame. I mean, I think it was Willow, but she had her up in a powerbomb position and basically kind of threw her backwards face first into the steel. And look, I'm not saying that it's fun to have your face thrown into a chain link fence, but of all the things that these women did to each other in this match, that simple spot would cause that type of blood loss. And in the first 5 minutes of the match, it was like, okay, I think we went from 0 to 100 a little too quick here. That was a little ridiculous. So she stood out for that, though, because she was in there for so long bleeding that by the time the match was over, a lot of the blood was gone and dried up. But for a good portion of the match, she was just covered in blood and then caked in blood. So Sky Blue stood out for that reason. To me, though, the real standouts in this match, honestly, were Megan Bain and Marina Shafir. Those are the two women who stood out the most to me. I like the way they did the finish. Yeah, that closing sequence, it made sense. They had Toni Storm was in there and Mina Shirakawa was in there as well. And they're tag team partners in this women's tag team title tournament. And they're like best friends now. And you had the heels. You had the triangle of madness holding down Toni Storm. So all she could do was watch as Marina Shafir locked in this choke on Mina. And Megan Bain was just brutalizing her with, it might have been Mercedes TBS championship, but she had one of the championship belts, and she's whipping her hard right across the back over and over and over and over again and right in front of Toni Storm, and all she could do is watch. And then finally, she surrenders to save her friend and to save her partner, and the heels win blood and guts. And it made sense in terms of the storytelling, because it's pretty clear that it's not official yet, but Toni and Mina, they're going to wrestle Megan Bain and Marina Shafir in the next round. So this really, of that tag team title tournament, so this really put some heat on a match that otherwise wouldn't have had any, you know, going into it. That's the story they told with that finish. It will play into this tournament. And can I also just say, like, what a beast Megan Bain is. Like, this woman shows up in Japan to work the Goddesses of Stardom Tag Team League tournament on Friday, the Tag League. That would have been on the 7th, right? November 7th. Three straight nights she worked. Then she flew back to the United States for blood and guts of all matches, right? Bleeding with tacks sticking out of her body. Then she flew right back to Japan to continue in the tournament. Then she flies back to the States for full gear, which is coming up next weekend, for whatever they may have her doing on that show. At least I think that was the plan, for her to be a part of Full Gear in some way, only to then fly right back to Japan to finish the tournament. Back and forth multiple times in the span of 3 weeks. You talk about jet lag. She's going to end up topping Hogan's record of wrestling 400 days in a year with that time zone difference. Then we had the men's blood and guts match. The women's one went 45 minutes. This one went almost an hour. This one went 54 minutes, which it did not need to go 54 minutes. And again, you had people freely going in and out of the cage throughout the match. I got to tell you, I was pretty bored through the first half of this match. There was not a lot of heat. It was a lot of the same rinse-repeat stuff we had already seen in the opening match. It picked up nicely, though, in the closing stretch. There was nothing crazy off the top of the cage. Mark Briscoe, who they did this angle where Briscoe was taken out in the back by the Don Callis family. So now the conglomeration and Darby Allin, they're a man down. Oh, my God, what are they going to do? And, of course, Mark Briscoe ends up coming out anyway. So he did wrestle in the match. He ended up on top of the cage with Wheeler Yuta. He actually gave Wheeler Yuta a J-driller on top of the cage, but then they climbed down. So there was no big crazy stunt bump off the top of the cage this year, which is fine. The big crazy spot belonged to Darby Allin. Surprise, surprise. And because there was so much fighting and brawling happening outside the cage, they ended up on top of one of the entrance tunnels. Gabe Kidd had run out to also assist the Death Riders, even though he wasn't supposed to be in the match. But they had tables set up next to the stage, next to one of the tunnels. And on top of the tunnel, Pac gorilla presses Darby over his head. And he dumps them all the way down after Gabe Kidd set those tables down below ablaze. And Darby crashes through the tables and he is engulfed in flames. He's like a ball of flames. And you could even see where his back was on fire for a few seconds even after he took the bump. Like the flames didn't extinguish right away. And because when he rolled over, you could see that there were spots on his back where he was on fire. And that was the last we saw of Darby Allin in this match. And that led into the finish, which I thought was great. Kyle O'Reilly was also bleeding. Everyone was bleeding. But Kyle O'Reilly is just bleeding profusely. They gave the win to Kyle O'Reilly. He was the MVP. He won it for the conglomeration. It was the biggest win of his AEW career by far. But it made sense. Because they had a couple of matches recently on TV where Moxley was doing everything in his power to avoid being trapped in a submission and tapping out, which is what he did against Darby at WrestleDream when he was locked in the Scorpion Deathlock. He did not want to go through that again. So he did everything in those matches to avoid tapping out, only here in Blood and Guts to finally tap out. And the crowd went crazy for the finish. So I like the storytelling here. I like the storytelling at the end of the women's match. I like the storytelling at the end of the men's match. Me personally, I'm not a huge fan of some of the excess, you know, violence and stunt bumps and all the blood is fine, but then you just kind of go overboard with it. So that's not my thing necessarily, but I love the finishes of the matches. I was a fan of that. And so much for this leading to anything with Moxley and the Death Riders. This was the finish that I pitched, and I was happy they did it. I said, it has to be Moxley. Moxley has to be the one who surrenders in this match. And that could be the beginning of the end of the Death Riders. I wasn't necessarily expecting them to gang up on him on Wednesday and beat the shit out of him, maybe this coming Wednesday. But then, you know, I caught up with what I needed to catch up with this morning from Collision last night. And I see that the Death Riders were on the show, and I see that Jon Moxley was on commentary for the opening match on the show. And he's brushing off their loss. In Blood and Guts, he's preaching about, I just want to bring positivity into this world, which was fucking hilarious. So I don't know if the idea is that he is just completely, you know, out to lunch, and he is completely delusional about all these losses that he has incurred for his crew, because this is now the third big loss since All In that Jon Moxley has suffered to embarrass the Death Riders, including losing the championship to Hangman Page. But there was no hint, there was no indication of anything with Moxley and the Death Riders or him being on the outs or anything like that. And maybe it'll happen, but if it is, there was no fucking sign of it on Collision last night, which I think is ridiculous. Now, AEW presents its Full Gear pay-per-view this coming Saturday from the Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey, with a 7 o'clock start time for their Tailgate Brawl pre-show, 8 p.m. start time for the main card. They're doing a tag team match on the pre-show with Big Boom AJ of the Costco Guys, teaming up with QT Marshall. Yes, they're on the same side now. They set this up on Ring of Honor television. They share a common enemy in the Don Callis family. They take on Trent Beretta and Rocky Romero. You know, keeping the Costco Guys stuff to the pre-show is where it belongs. I can't believe the Costco Guys stuff is still going on here, but you keep it to the pre-show, fine. It has no business being on the main card when they already have a ton of matches on their main card, so keep it on the pre-show, that's fine. If I'm AJ, I'd be watching some old Sting, Ric Flair, Horseman tapes to prepare myself for what's probably about to happen to him. Also, they've added a $200,000 tag team match. Boy, Tony Khan has a little too much money to throw around. $200,000 with the Acclaimed, who don't want to have anything to do with each other, but they're being forced back together slowly, week by week. The Bang Bang Gang, Big Bill and Brian Keith, and the Outrunners. Winner gets $200,000. It would be more entertaining to see the Outrunners win the fake money, but they don't do anything with the Outrunners. So it'll probably be Caster and Bowens winning the money. On the main card, they're going to crown the first ever AEW national champion with a casino gauntlet match. I already talked about the national title last week, which is completely unnecessary. All we know so far is that Bobby Lashley Shelton Benjamin, Ricochet, the Gates of Agony, and Jetspeed have all declared for the match. And without knowing who else is in the damn thing, it's hard to predict a new champion, but I'll toss one name out there and say that we get the return of Switchblade Jay White. Jay White walks out as the new national champion. I still think adding this title is completely unnecessary and dilutes their other belts. MVP's boys are in. He is not. But I do have some news on MVP. He spoke with the website AdventureGamers.com, and he revealed that he just signed a contract extension with AEW, saying, "I'll be with AEW for quite a while in my current capacity, and hopefully beyond in a managerial capacity, and to whatever extent possibly behind the scenes." But he talked about other stuff, too. And in comparing Tony Khan to Paul Levesque and Vince McMahon, he said, "It's very different because Tony Khan is a completely different human being with a completely different personality. He's just a nice guy and a good person. I've never had any kind of relationship with Triple H. Vince I was able to work with, and with Vince knows exactly what he wants, how he wants to do it. And if you can present something that is better, sometimes Vince will listen, but when Vince has a vision, that's it. You go with it. There's no second guessing it. Tony Khan is a lot more interactive, and he will take in a lot more ideas. He's more willing to be pliable when it comes to his vision and how he wants to present it and what he's willing to do or add or change it. He's just a nice guy. It's funny, like his energy level, he's always happy, and I've never seen him be mean to somebody. It's a much different environment where WWE was very corporate, very tight-laced, for some people even uncomfortable, and they're made to feel like they're walking on eggshells and people are scared of getting fired. That environment doesn't exist in AEW. It's way more relaxed. No one's walking on eggshells. The boss has time for everybody, and it's super fun, no stress." On Bret Hart and others who have criticized Paul Levesque, who he is no fan of, he's made that very clear. MVP was very blunt. He said, "I've said before, I call him a coward and a liar. Let's put it like this. If you really want to, you can go to YouTube and you can look up the interviews of various wrestlers through the years of what their opinion is of the man. Interviews of guys that were his friends, what they had to say about the guy. I can think of more guys that dislike him than I can think of ones that do like him. And people say MVP's salty or he's bitter. Like, no, I have personal issues with the dude, stemming from professional stuff, but just the things that he does, how he carries himself, I just don't have respect for the guy. The newer generation, they don't know that guy yet. So the ones that came up underneath him in NXT, they think he's brilliant, and a lot of them should, for the hand that he's had in their career, but the guys that had to work with him back in the day will tell you a different story almost overwhelmingly. And so it's not just me saying it. It's Sports Illustrated saying it. It's the Bleacher Report. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of a different promo here. He said, so it's not just me saying it. There's guys who are way up the totem pole than me that are telling you that this guy's no bueno. I don't know where the heat stems from. I mean, it stems from the MVP side, at the very least. But what caused it, we don't know. He's never pointed, to my knowledge, he's never pointed to any one specific incident, although supposedly it may go back to when he was first on SmackDown years ago as a wrestler. So now we're going back to like the mid to late 2000s. So this is not just a recent thing, because he knew Triple H from the days, you know, of him as an in-ring performer, when Triple H cared about Triple H and nothing else, right? Not the Papa H crap that people talk about now, which is creepy as hell, by the way, when people call him that. So I can't speak to his personal experiences with the man. Clearly something he said or the way he carried himself when dealing with him rubbed MVP the wrong way, and it gave him an impression of Triple H that really made him lose all respect for the man. The stories about Triple H have been out there for years, right? Going back over 20 years, about how self-absorbed he was, you know, trying to protect his spot, which, by the way, a lot of top guys have done in wrestling over the decades, but most, if not all, of those top guys did not have the power and position that Triple H found himself in WWE. Not all of them can be part of that inner circle and those production meetings and the way that Triple H was when he was still a performer. That's the big difference here. But he's very protective of his spot. He would make comments about guys behind their back that you know, may well have affected their career in some cases, depending on what he's saying in these meetings to a Vince McMahon or a Bruce Pritchard or a Pat Patterson or whoever would have had some level of power and influence at the time. Like, oh, hey, this guy doesn't have it. Or, hey, this guy did this. Or, hey, this guy did that. Or he's too small. You know, whatever the comments were, that could have a profound effect on someone's career. Now, are we to believe that as he's gotten older and his priorities and his responsibilities have changed to where it's not all about him anymore, that he's a changed man, right? I'm not around him. I don't work for him. I can't say for sure. And also keep in mind that, you know, Triple H almost died a few years ago. So that could change your worldview real quick. As a viewer, what I see on TV and what I see from all of the interviews and podcasts and TED Talks and whatever else this guy's been doing is that he still has a very, very healthy ego. And he likes to make things about himself. That hasn't changed. I don't think that part of Triple H has changed. And I joked about it when I saw him in the ring on Monday in Boston, the first person we saw on the show on what should have been a segment all about John Cena. He had to be there front and center, knowing the house was sold out, to make sure that he was involved when he really was not needed, right? Not when Raw was already, they already have a general manager on the show. Yet there he was. Right, the credits at the end of the shows, which we never had before. All of a sudden, the last couple of years, now we do, to make sure that Paul Levesque is the first name that we see at the end of every show. WrestleMania in Vegas next year, when the first commercial dropped a few weeks ago, who was the first face that we saw in the ad? Paul Levesque. The signature that opens every show, he made sure to add his voice to it. So it's the first thing we hear on every show, like, he is enjoying his new position. That much is clear. The ego is still there. Beyond that, when it comes to the way he treats people, MVP would know better than I would, but it is an interesting point that he makes about how different the perspective might be for someone coming up in that system in the last decade, let's say, who would have worked with him in NXT, and now on the main roster, they're working with him there too, as compared to the people who worked with him 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And they saw a very different side of Triple H. You look at Shawn Michaels. He's Mr. NXT right now, and people glow about Shawn Michaels. That wasn't the case 30 years ago. But how much of that was also him being hopped up on God knows what? He may have been an asshole anyway, but I'm sure that that didn't help. And every now and then, a story will leak out about an interaction that someone had with him after he came back to the company and he became born again. That doesn't really paint him in the best light, right? Shane Helms had one of those stories many years ago. Dax Harwood, Stevie Richards. Just to remind you that the old Shawn Michaels is still there, like buried beneath the surface. But I bring him up because by and large, people are very complimentary of him today. And how much, you know, he is a pleasure to work with and how great of a boss he is to work for. People can change. I'm not so sure that's the case with Triple H, but people can change. But back to Full Gear. In the first ever $1 million trios match, more money, Kenny Omega and Jurassic Express, they take on Josh Alexander and the Young Bucks. I'm going with Josh Alexander and the Young Bucks for the win. Mark Briscoe challenges Kyle Fletcher for the TNT Championship, no disqualification. And if Briscoe loses, he must join the Don Callis family. Because if there's one thing we need, actually two things, if there's two things we need in this company, it's more belts and more members of the Don Callis family. Mark Briscoe failed in his first attempt. I think he wins the title. Here we have a new TNT champion. Brody King and Bandido, they defend their AEW World Tag Team titles against the former champions FTR. Dax and Cash, I think they're taking the titles here to set up for the eventual return of Adam Copeland and the inevitable Cope and Christian tag team match. They've added the Bastard Pack against Darby Allin after Pack press-slammed Darby through a flaming table in Blood and Guts. Still, with Darby and the Death Riders, we are continuing this. This should be a win for Darby. The reigning TBS champion, now Mercedes 13 belts after last night's House of Glory show, your new APAC Wrestling Women's Champion, Mercedes Moné is looking for title number 14 when she challenges Chris Statlander for the AEW Women's World Championship A year ago at Full Gear, Monet beat Statlander to retain the TBS title. And then she beat her again at World's End. Two great matches, but two losses for Statlander. She got a measure of revenge in Blood and Guts, where she put Mercedes through a table outside the cage with a Samoan drop. Even though her team did go on to lose. This needs to be a Statlander win. I think it will be a Chris Statlander win, and she will retain her title. Not only because she has already lost twice to this woman, but because the story should be Mercedes cannot win the world championship. This is now her second bite at the apple. The one blemish on her record came against Toni Storm at All In. She didn't get the job done. That will be the result here as well. No matter how many belts she collects to make herself feel better, she cannot win the big one. And maybe 13 ends up being her unlucky number. So she fails again here, and then she starts to drop each one of those belts one by one until she is left with nothing. And then and only then does she finally win the world title. That's the story they tell with this. And that's the one that makes sense here, because to put your world title on someone only for her to then go out and start losing a bunch of different independent belts doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. You have her do that first. Then you put the world championship on her. But before this match, Mercedes is wrestling Red Velvet in a title unification on Dynamite for the Ring of Honor Women's Television title. Mercedes has the interim title. Velvet's been out with an injury since June. She has the actual belt. I don't think this would count as number 14 because she already has the interim version. It would just go from interim to official. And Hangman Adam Page defends the AEW World Championship in a steel cage match against Samoa Joe. This is to keep Powerhouse Hobbs and Katsuyori Shibata out of the match. And we all know how well these cages work to prevent that from happening. By the way, we're also coming off two Blood and Guts matches. And now we're getting a standalone cage match, which is just ridiculous. Of course, Hangman is retaining. He is not losing the title. And I believe we get the return of MJF after the match is over. That's the big cliffhanger they go off the air with, which leads to him cashing in his Casino Gauntlet contract for a championship match at World's End. And at that point, I think you're looking at the brand new AEW World Champion. Now, it doesn't look like we're going to get the finals of the Women's Tag Team Title Tournament on this show. On Dynamite Wednesday, we have two quarterfinal round matches. It's Toni Storm and Mina Shirakawa taking on Riho and Alex Windsor. And then Tayjay takes on Megan Bain and Marina Shafir. So just time-wise, I don't think there's any time left to do the finals on the pay-per-view. But that's coming up on Wednesday, which, by the way, is a three-hour show. It is a combined Dynamite and Collision show. 3 hours. The two most evil words in my vocabulary all week. It won't be a three-hour mailbag, I'll promise you that. Let's go through these questions here. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Dane from St. Louis did want to mention, he got notified that Eric Bischoff's book, Grateful, by Eric Bischoff and Guy Evans, is either out or coming out in the next few weeks on Audible. So again, I mentioned the Audible link earlier, the Brett book, the Natty book. If you're interested, there's also going to be a new Eric Bischoff book. You could probably pre-order it right now using our link, so just be aware of that. Dak from St. Paul, Minnesota. The PWI women's list has come out, and Mercedes Moné was ranked number one. Naturally, people online are losing their minds about this, and it still baffles me that it seems so many don't understand it's a kayfabe list. Just wanted to see what your thoughts on the women's list were overall. It is a kayfabe list, mostly. So yes, PWI released its list of the top 250 women's wrestlers of the year. And again, it relies heavily on kayfabe. They consider win-loss records and championships and your influence within your chosen company or the industry as a whole, among other criteria. And the evaluation period for this ran from October 1st of last year through September 30th of this year. And so with that in mind, Mercedes Moné topped the list at number one for the first time in her career. She came in second back in 2016. And she didn't rank at all last year because she didn't have enough matches. And it's well-deserved. She had one loss all year. That was to Toni Storm, who ranked right behind her at number two. She was number one in last year's rankings. So she went almost undefeated for the entire year. She has held on to the TBS championship for the entire evaluation period, and she has won 10 or 11 other titles in the meantime, some of which she has gone back and defended, right? And that cannot be understated, the influence that that has on these independent promotions, the tickets that she helps sell for those shows, the exposure that she has given to some of these women that she's worked with, even if it just gets them on WWE's radar or AEW's radar, right? Then you factor in the quality of her matches. Mercedes at number one is really a no-brainer, and if not number one, then number two for sure. So there's really nothing to lose your mind over unless you're someone who just doesn't like her, or if you're not a fan of her winning all these championships, which is fine, and that is perfectly fine to not be a fan of it and think it's too much. But to say, well, yeah, I can't believe she's number one. Like, what? Like, why wouldn't she be number one? Why wouldn't she be number one? Just look at the criteria they based the list on. Of course she's going to be number one. There's nothing to argue here. They went with Toni Storm at number two, which, again, I can't argue with that. If I had one gripe with the list, Io Sky was ranked too low. They had her at number six. Io is one of the best in-ring performers in the world right now. But that period after WrestleMania where she did nothing, I think, really hurt her. You know, she was the champion, but, like, can you tell me, can you name me off the top of your head anything memorable about Io Sky's run and what she did from post-WrestleMania until that Evolution match with Rhea Ripley? Because I can't think of a fucking thing. You know, and I think that really hurt her, or else she would have been ranked higher. So I guess it's less of a gripe with their rankings and just more of a gripe with how she was used in that period between WrestleMania and Evolution, when she had that great match with Rhea Ripley. Saya Katani, the reigning New Japan Strong Women's Champion and Stardom Champion, ranked number three. I can't speak to her because I haven't seen any of the matches that she's had this year. I probably should. But she ranked number 89 last year. She jumped all the way to number three. Number four was Tiffany Stratton, who spent most of the year undefeated as the women's champion. Stephanie Vaquer was number five. This would have included her winner-take-all win over Julia in NXT back in March and winning the Women's World Championship at WrestlePalooza, but not her crown jewel win, since that came after the deadline. Number six, as I mentioned, was Io Sky. Number seven was Athena, with her 1,000-plus days as Ring of Honor Women's World Champion, but her influence is only going to extend so far, so long as she's stuck in Ring of Honor hell. She does own a women's promotion of her own down in Texas, so she has influence in that regard. Number eight was Saray. Number nine was Naomi, who had a breakout year. It's too bad it ended right as she was really starting to truly break out. And number 10 was Rhea Ripley, who ranked number three last year. This year was down to 10th. That's a pretty damn good list. Becky Lynch did not make the list. You need a minimum of 10 singles matches or 6 matches in the course of 6 separate months within the review period. Becky had 9 non-tag team matches during the period and only wrestled in 4 different months. So she did not qualify. It's the same reason Roman Reigns didn't make the PWI Top 500 last year. He only wrestled 6 matches all year. Adrian from Dallas. Do you see John Cena having an open challenge for the Intercontinental title and Sheamus coming out and saying something to the effect of, I'm not waiting for December 13th, I want a match tonight, and having Sheamus beat Cena for the championship? This would be poetic as how Sheamus beat Cena for his first WWE championship, or seeing as how he beat him for his first title, and now he beats him for the one title that Sheamus is seeking. No, I don't see that happening, and honestly, it just doesn't feel... It doesn't feel like the right time for it because, again, Sheamus is in the tournament. So it would be kind of weird for him to be like, well, I'm in the middle of this tournament that I just qualified for to move on to the next round. But you know what? I don't want to wait. So why don't we just wrestle right now? Like, why don't you just tell people that Sheamus is not winning the tournament? Like, yeah, it doesn't work. If he wasn't in the tournament, I'm totally open to it. But no, it's just not going to happen. Curtis from Toronto, this week WWE announced a brand new partnership with Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment, centered around a Monday Night Raw show on January 26th of 2026. This partnership will see the show air from the city with NHL players appearing on the air and vice versa. WWE stars appearing at the Leafs game later that week. MLSE operates Scotiabank Arena, where many of the WWE pay-per-views are held, as well as TV tapings, but also the home to a lot of AEW events. Vice versa, the Coca-Cola Coliseum, where WWE runs house shows and AEW often run their TV tapings, is under the MLSE banner until 2035 and potentially 2045, based on the city's offer for an extension on their agreement. Is WWE essentially locking AEW out of Toronto and the biggest Canadian market? And then bonus question, TNA do their TV tapings at Rebel Entertainment Complex in Toronto, which is smaller but has spectacular audio and video. Do you think that space would be a fit for AEW? Yeah, I think it would be a space for AEW, especially if it's a smaller venue. Then they can pack it in and make it look good. This new agreement with MLSE, by the way, that you asked about in your main question, it will not preclude AEW from running there, because they were asked about this, and a spokesperson told a reporter for TSN that the new agreement with WWE does not prevent other events in our venues. So I know there was some hay made about this week, and is WWE shutting them out of the market? They are not shutting them out of the market, and that is straight from an MLSE spokesperson. So the answer is no. Chuck, from the Joker's Voice channel on YouTube. First time emailing. Love your podcast and your channel. You and JD are huge inspirations for my own channel. Well, thank you, brother. I love hearing that. Again, it's the Joker's Voice channel on YouTube. But he says, question, you guys talked about Julia and the quote-unquote burial she got on SmackDown against Chelsea Green, saying that she is damaged goods as far as SmackDown goes. Would you be opposed to moving Julia to Raw and grouping her with Asuka and Kairi and using the Freebird rule for the tag team championship? My reasoning is that Asuka wanted Io to adhere to a master and student relationship. This didn't happen, so Asuka is still looking for another student to take under her wing. Julia fits that role. Also, Julia being associated with Asuka helps rebuild her credibility, as Asuka is pretty much the standard of excellence. This way, Julia can also have the leash taken off and tap into her more aggressive, ruthless in-ring style. You could do it. I think Julia probably has to be moved from SmackDown. And I hate saying that, because SmackDown, the last thing SmackDown needs right now is fewer women on the roster. I'm not a proponent of, you know, cutting women from that roster. They need more women on that roster, but they have done such a horrific job with Julia this year that I just think moving her to Raw or moving her back to NXT for a period of time to rebuild her is probably the best course of action here. You want to move her to Raw and pair her up with the Kabuki Warriors? I mean, some people may look at that and go, oh, of course, WWE taking all the Japanese girls, taking all... Yeah, that's what Bill Goldberg would say. Taking all the Japanese girls and bunching them up, right? Let's put all the Joshi wrestlers together. But you know what? It may be the best thing for Julia. That's what it takes, then so be it, because the Kabuki Warriors are getting a bit of a push, right? They're on TV. They're featured every single week. They just won the women's tag team titles. I'd be okay with that. Sean from Byron, Illinois, been a listener for 12 years. Like you, I was a huge fan of the black and gold era of NXT under Triple H. I was really excited when he took over WWE Creative, but it feels like the honeymoon phase has worn off, probably starting around Elimination Chamber this year with The Rock's involvement. I understand that running NXT against Raw and SmackDown is a completely different challenge, but I often find myself scratching my head at some of the creative choices on the main roster. Triple H did such an amazing job with guys like Tommaso Ciampa, Johnny Gargano, Andrade, and others in NXT, yet it feels like he hasn't really tried to elevate his former NXT talent on the main roster, even to mid-card title contention. What do you make of the apparent downgrade in Triple H's creative direction compared to his NXT days in the initial period where he first took over creative? Also, does Triple H truly have full creative control, or is it more of a collaborative process where he drafts ideas and higher-ups like Nick Khan or Mark Shapiro need to approve them? I'm not entirely sure how the TKO hierarchy works. Well, I am not in the TKO hierarchy, but I would be shocked if Nick Khan and Mark Shapiro had any sort of say or needed approval on day-to-day creative ideas. If it's a creative idea relative to someone like The Rock or a celebrity that they're going to bring in, like Travis Scott, Fiend, then yes, I'm sure Nick Khan is involved. Maybe Ari Emanuel has some say in the matter. But no, I cannot imagine that on the day-to-day, week-to-week Raw and SmackDown creative ideas, we're going into War Games now. What War Games teams do we want? And stuff like that. You know, Mark Shapiro doesn't give a shit. You know, Nick Khan doesn't have any say in that. That's Triple H and the people that work underneath him as part of the creative team. It's Triple H, it's Bruce Pritchard, it's Michael Hayes, it's Road Dogg, and it's all those people you saw in the writer's room when you watched WWE Unreal. So there is a collaboration there, but Triple H is the chief content officer. He has final say in everything. Even if it's not his idea, he may say, okay, that's a great idea, I'll go with that. And maybe some of it is his idea. And the other thing to consider also is, you know, when he was running NXT, Triple H was not writing the shows. Like, Triple H did not have a pen and paper and sit there and write out TV each week. He had writers working for him. And I think Ryan Katz, and maybe I'm getting the name wrong, I think it was Ryan Katz, though, who, I don't want to say he was really the one who was coming up with all the stories in NXT, but like, Triple H had his writers and he had his right-hand man or right-hand men down there. But he got credit as the face of NXT. We don't know how many of those great ideas and great match combinations that we saw on those takeover shows, like how much of that was Triple H's idea, how much of that was a Ryan Katz idea or someone else's idea. I don't know if William Regal at the time had any input into the creative process. So, you know, I think it's one of those things where we got to be careful not to give him all the credit or all the blame, because there's a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot of team members. You know, people talk about SmackDown right now. Road Dogg, fire Road Dogg. Well, you know, yeah, Road Dogg may not be the best there, but it's still Triple H's show. And if nothing else, if the ideas aren't his, he's putting his stamp of approval on them, and that's what we're seeing on television. Main roster and NXT are two totally different beasts. NXT is a much smaller roster. NXT is also a very different roster. It's a less experienced roster. Raw and SmackDown, even just in terms of the formatting of the shows, you know, is different from NXT. And there are other obligations and responsibilities as far as things to promote on the shows. That goes to the formatting of the shows. You have a much bigger roster to work with. You have a roster that has a lot of older talent on it as compared to NXT. I mean, just look at the main event scene right now in WWE. Not a lot of what I would call young guys in the main event picture. So it's two totally different beasts. He's dealing with certain egos maybe and veteran talents that, you know, he wasn't necessarily working with in NXT. They were his kids, and he was working with a lot of younger talents and older talents too. He did bring in some veteran talents from the independent scene when he basically raided the independent scene. So, you know, there was a mix. But yeah, of course there's a big difference between the two rosters. But at the end of the day, creative is creative. You either have it or you don't. You either have good ideas or you have terrible ideas that are not going to hit. And I don't know that there's any one explanation for why. Yes, there's a honeymoon period at the beginning. I think a lot of it, frankly, also is just it's not Vince. That's what a lot of it was. It's not Vince. Now, there are things that he shares in common with Vince McMahon, I think, in terms of his just overall philosophy, things he learned from his father-in-law over the years. But I think a lot of people were just happy, like, knowing it's not Vince. Wow. And then you hear from talents, you say, wow, we have more input now into creative, and the handcuffs aren't on the way they used to be. And that's great. There's a lot of positives that came out of Vince McMahon no longer being there and no longer being the head of creative. However, that doesn't mean that there are no issues. That doesn't mean that all of a sudden creative is great and everything's great and all the stories are great. Clearly, that's not what it means. But I do think the way that they probably operate, like if you're a talent there and you worked under Vince McMahon and now you work under Triple H in this current regime, probably you're going to look at that and go, yeah, it's better now. It's a lot easier to navigate now. You know, I feel like I have more of a voice in the process, or if I have an idea, maybe it's, you know, they're more open to allowing me to go out there and do something, or go out there and maybe not stick to a script. That's all a plus. That's all a massive positive if that's the case. But creative is creative. You either have great ideas or you don't. Right now, there's not a whole lot of ideas on WWE television, I think, that are really hitting in the way that you would want them to. And that does fall on Triple H, because you get all the credit when things are great, But when things are not great, you can't deflect to other people. You get all the credit, you get all the blame. That's how it works. Binder from Milwaukee, two questions about Chris Jericho's potential WWE return. One, should it happen at the Rumble? And two, will he be Judas-themed Jericho or Y2J Jericho? I do think that he will probably be back at the Rumble. I think that initial return appearance, for the sake of all the WWE fans who maybe don't watch AEW and just remember Y2J and, oh my God, where's he been for 6 years? It's going to be to the Y2J music. If you want an example, just look to what we saw on Friday night with, you know, Matt Cardona on SmackDown. He came out not as Matt Cardona. He came out as Zack Ryder. I think he comes out initially to the Y2J music. I would like to see him going forward, though, use the Judas music for his last run. Because I like Judas, and I think hearing it in WWE would be something different. That would be kind of cool. I think we're looking at a Rumble return, and I think we're looking at a WrestleMania feud and match with LA Knight. Justin from Chicago, I know there's a lot of speculation about Jey Uso turning heel, but what if both Usos turn heel at Survivor Series? Roman and Jimmy end up rounding out Team Punk for War Games, and towards the end of the match, Roman has Bron Breakker lined up for a spear. As he charges him, Jimmy hits Roman with a super kick. A stunned Jay and CM Punk confront Jimmy, only for Jimmy and Jay to lock eyes and smile and hit double super kicks on CM Punk. Breakker then hits Roman with a spear to win the match, further serving as a catalyst for a potential WrestleMania match. On Raw, the Usos simply acknowledge it is a business decision, citing that Brock Lesnar and CM Punk and Roman Reigns all saw their careers peak under the guidance of Paul Heyman. And they also note that they had the longest reign in WWE history as champions, while Heyman was the wise man for the bloodline. This could take Jay out of the main event scene as a single, while also providing Raw's tag team scene with a much-needed shot in the arm. Maybe you could even get a short program with the Usos in an eventual babyface New Day one last time. What are your thoughts? I think that having the Usos back in the tag team division to give that division a shot in the arm makes sense, and I would be fine with Jay being out of the main event picture for a while and having him do something different, even going heel, even if he stayed single, but, you know, went heel. Just, again, the fact that everything has to revolve around the bloodline is just, I'm over it at this point. Another War Games, and we're going to have the Usos turn on Roman, and the family drama continues. It's been years of this shit. Like, I don't know. It's just, to me, it's just played out. The story peaked a couple of years ago, and they're just milking it for all it's worth, and it just doesn't do anything for me at this point. But, I mean, if you got to do something with these guys, I could think of worse ideas. I'm not, you know, opposed to the idea. One thing I do like, not necessarily this idea, no offense, but I think the idea that you mentioned of Bron Breakker being the one to get the win if the heels win and he beats Roman, that could be the catalyst to an eventual WrestleMania match in Vegas. That idea I like. Daniel from Houston. I don't see many people talking about the idea of Dominic turning face. Really? Because that's all people seem to be talking about. You could have Ray versus Dominic for the AAA mega title or just a singles match at Survivor Series. You saw how Dom was upset with the Judgment Day not being there for him during his match with John Cena. So what if the Judgment Day promised to be in Dom's corner for his match, and yet again, Dom loses to Ray? What if the Judgment Day turn on Dom after the match? You could have Ray at the ramp looking conflicted on what to do. He'll be in San Diego, so you can imagine just how big of a pop it would be for Ray to go back into the ring and help his son. This then leads to Ray and Dom teaming up against Finn and JD McDonagh. Not a bad way to do it. The only problem I have with it is that I still think it's too soon. Especially Liv Morgan hasn't even come back yet. You can't turn Dom babyface before Liv Morgan comes back and rejoins the Judgment Day. Or we know what she's going to be doing when she comes back. So next year maybe, but I think it's too soon to turn Dom. Now the fans can continue to cheer for him, but I think the actual turn, I would not be doing it right now. Aaron from Indiana, with it being a month away from John Cena's retirement match, I was wondering where he would fall on your greatest of all time list. This could include things like impact on the industry, ticket and merch sales, etc. So if we're talking about WWE goats, because wrestling is more than just WWE. I mean, if you were to make a list of all-time greats, John Cena would not even be in the top 10. All right? Like, wrestling is more than just the United States. You'd have El Santo, you'd have Inoki, and so on. But in terms of WWE, he's not even in my top five. Like, that's reserved for Hulk Hogan, and this is in no particular order, but Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, Steve Austin, Bret Hart, and Shawn Michaels. Kurt Angle is right there with him. And honestly, Savage and Angle are both like the complete pro wrestler to me. They had it all. They could do anything. So it's tough for me to leave Kurt out of the top five, but I'm thinking for me, that's my top five. Then you get into The Rock and Undertaker and Brock Lesnar. I'm not sure exactly where Triple H or John Cena would rank for me. Cena might be top 10. You know, casting him as the generic top babyface for so long hurt him with me. When I know there was this great heel run in him during that period, maybe I'd feel differently had Vince not been so scared to turn him. But he didn't want to give up that sweet merch money. You know, when you factor in other things like merch sales and his role as an ambassador for the company, all the Make-A-Wish stuff, he was a great representative for that company. I would have loved to have had John Cena as my top guy, because he was probably very agreeable to whatever they wanted him to do, and you knew that you could rely on him and not get him, he was not going to get himself into any trouble. Of all the names that I mentioned, he was probably the one who gave them the least amount of headaches. And he just seems like a genuinely good human being. I can't always say that for a lot of the people I have in my top five, unfortunately. But this is not a list of the top five greatest human beings in wrestling history. This is my list of the top five GOATs, at least in WWE. My list will be different than your list. I don't give a shit. Right? I mean, and again, those guys, I may love them as performers, but clearly they all come with baggage of varying degrees. But we all have our favorites, you know, for one reason or another. But even weighing their impact on the company and on the industry, Hogan's impact is undeniable. So many people would not be wrestling fans today, myself included, very likely, were it not for Hulk Hogan. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels have probably influenced more talent on the roster right now than most, right? Inspired them to want to become a pro wrestler or influenced them in some way in their in-ring style. John Cena is one of the elite talkers in the history of the company when he wasn't playing the role of narrator on the shows each week for everybody else's storylines. You know, he's had more classic matches than some people will give him credit for. I defended him on that even back then, back in the day on this show. You know, he didn't have to be the best wrestler to go out there and have great matches. His matches with Edge and CM Punk and Shawn Michaels and AJ Styles and Brock Lesnar, like, he had tons of great matches. Cena's great. Was he overpushed there for a while? You bet your ass he was. He was Vince's boy. So was Hogan. Doesn't take away from his body of work. He's one of the greatest in WWE history, but he's not the greatest. He's not my greatest. But you can let me know who you think is your greatest and send in any other questions or comments you have for the mailbag. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on X, @Solemonster, and of course subscribe on YouTube, where I am live multiple times throughout the week, and you get some bonus content as well. Just search for Solemonster Sounds Off. We just passed 89,000 subscribers, which means the march to 90K has begun, so you can help get me there. The next time I am live will be on YouTube. It will be tomorrow night. It's going to be a big Raw show. John Cena's final Raw from Madison Square Garden, so join me live for the post show as soon as Raw is done. I will be live on Tuesday night over on JD's channel for Tuesday Night Titans, and then Wednesday for the go-home 3-hour Dynamite before Full Gear, and then Friday night for... I will not be live Friday night for SmackDown, because on Friday I will be in Chicago for House of Glory. That's where I will be. And so if you are not watching SmackDown live, I will be broadcasting on Triller TV Plus, and then back here next Sunday for episode 939 of the Solemonster Sounds Off. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great rest of your week. I will see some of you in Chicago on Friday, and back here for more Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
So you got Moxley on one side, you got Darby on the other. Moxley said, look, I did what I could for Danielson, but this is a war for the future of the sport. And for their credit, you know, they're running what is it with these Shield guys? You know, here on this show, you've got Jon Moxley forming his own faction, and coming out every week and talking about the future of the industry, the future of the company, the future of the sport. You got Seth Rollins on the other show forming his own faction and coming out and basically doing the same thing. I'm fighting for the future, right? Everything is so epic. Like this match that you and I are about to have, Cody, it's a fight for the future of this company. Like, fuck off. What is this nonsense? I don't recall like Stone Cold or The Rock or The Undertaker coming out on television every week, or John Cena or Randy Orton, even if you want to use a different era as an example, coming out on television and cutting these fucking boring promos on television every single week over and over and over again about the same fucking shit. We gotta save the future of the company. How about you worry about yourself? How about worrying about the here and now and not fucking 5 or 10 years from now? What is it with these Shield guys? At least Roman Reigns doesn't give a fuck about the future. He comes out, he just cares about himself. I respect that. Fuck everybody else.
The Sala Monster sounds off
since 2007,
bringing you the good, the bad, and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Sala Monster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Sala Monster.
I love you so long.